Narayat Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kathitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashradashadhyayinim Ambatvamani Santatami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavad Varshinim. Karya karana kartritve Hetu prakriti ruchate, hetu prakriti ruchate, purusha sukatukanam, purusha sukatukanam, bhoktritve hetu ruchate, bhoktritve hetu ruchate, karya, karana, kartritve, hetuhu, prakritihi, ruchate. Purushaha sukha dukhanam bhoktritve hetuhu uchate. He says, karya karana often means cause and effect, where the karya is the effect, karana is the cause. That's a very typical translation, but we're going to take it two ways here. Shankara takes it two ways, and Swamiji in his commentary. Karya, you may have heard this term, karya karana sangata. Karya karana sangata is the body-mind-sense-organs complex, sometimes it's called, where the karya, being the effect, is the physical body. The karya is the physical body. The karana are the sense organs and the mind, the chitta. The sense organs and the mind are the karana. So when I say karya karana, it means the whole jiva, the sense organs, the mind, and the physical body. So here, when we say kartritve hetuhu prakriti uchate, the prakriti uchate is called prakritihi uchate. The prakriti is called the hetu, the cause for the creation, the kartritva, of the body, mind, sense organs. That's one way of taking this. What we're doing here in this verse, we're talking, what is the prakriti? What is the range of the prakriti? And what is the range of the purusha? So here in this first meaning, the prakriti is responsible for the body, the mind, the sense organs, the upadi. The body, mind, sense organs, whatever can be taken as an upadi. Remember, upadi means conditioning agent. So whatever is taken for the eye in terms of the physical body, the sense organs, the mind, whatever the organs of action are, whatever make up this body, mind, sense organs that we take to be ourself, right? Understand? Whatever I take to be me, and upadi is what we mean by upadi, or conditioning adjunct, is what lends itself to identification. Right? So I can say, I am the body, or I am any quality of the body. I am my mind, or any quality of my mind. I am my sense organs, or any quality of my sense organs. I'm the seer, I'm the hearer, I'm deaf, I'm hearing, whatever. All of the different types of antakarana vrittis, sukha dukkha, the emotions that we have, the intellections, the memories that we have, the imaginations that we have, any of the qualities or capacities of the mind, those are upadis. So these upadis are encapsulated by this karya karana. So we look at the prakriti is the prakriti, which is comprised of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. This prakriti is responsible for the physical body, mind, sense organs. Okay? Then purushaha, the purushaha, sukha dukha nam bhoktritve hetuhu uchate. The purusha is the cause. So it says purushaha hetuhu uchate. The purusha is the cause for the enjoyership of sukha and dukkha, etc. Sukha and dukkha means pleasure and pain. So what's happening here is what's happening is we're dividing the total experience, including subject and object, the total experience of reality, let's say like that, the totality of our experience. We're dividing it into two, into the purusha and the prakriti. Okay? Who's responsible for what? We have these two. The prakriti is responsible, really. So the first meaning, when they're talking about the prakriti, is responsible in terms of the jiva for the body, mind, sense organs complex. The purusha is responsible for the conscious being because of whom there's enjoyership. There's experience. Without a conscious being, there is no experience of the prakriti. So by experience, the experiencer, so to speak, is the enjoyer, right? If there's no enjoyer, you can even imagine Newton's clockwork creation. You can imagine something like a clock moving, but there's no conscious being to enjoy the movement. So you wind up a clock, and it's ticking away, but it's inert. So prakriti, from its own standpoint, is inert. If you were to remove the consciousness from it, there would be no experience, right? There's just inert matter ticking away. But when you bring in the purusha, then this matter, what we call matter, in fact, as we'll see, there's no such thing as matter. Because satya mitya, there's really only consciousness. But from the standpoint of the prakriti, there can be hands that grasp, and a voice that talks, and vrittis that are thought modifications that are moving through. But if there's no consciousness, there's no enjoyership, there's no knowership, you know, there's no one receiving all of that motion. So here the purusha is responsible for the consciousness, but the prakriti is responsible for everything that we're conscious of. We can put it like that. Everything that can be objectified is prakriti. The purusha is the conscious being, which is the self of all that can be objectified. And so without that self, there is no knowership. Okay? Now, to make this clear, we're not saying that we're, and as I unfold this a little bit more, it's not at all that consciousness from its own standpoint is a knower. Consciousness is just consciousness. Brahman is Brahman. Awareness is just simple awareness. Your being is not performing any type of function like that from its own standpoint. But from the standpoint of the prakriti, everything in the prakriti is known. But without consciousness, there's nothing to bring about that knownness of the prakriti. So let me give another example. If I have a thought, right? Say that the sense organs, my sense organs are, because of my sense organs, focused on that painting. The sense organs are, as an instrument, think of them as an instrument. The sense organs are, as an instrument, giving the mind a vritti, a thought modification of this painting. You know? It's kind of like a camera. If I take a picture with a camera and I point the lens, you know, at an object and then I click the camera, I'm able to get a picture of whatever I've directed the camera at. Right? But when I click the picture and I capture it, you know, I capture the picture, does that picture enjoy itself? I mean, is the picture, which has been captured in the camera, is that picture known? Well, the picture isn't known without consciousness. It's just simply a picture. So now look at here. If with my sense organs, I'm able to capture, my mind is able to capture the picture of the painting through the use of my sense organs, that's what we call an antakarna vritti, the vritti is there. But if we're only looking at the vritti from its own standpoint, without the chaitanya, without consciousness, we have the vritti, but there's no enjoyment of the vritti because there's no consciousness. So what is responsible for the enjoyment or the experience itself, you know, which we give to the vritti, that requires the purusha, the atma, Brahman. That is the idea. So now, when we're using this kind of language, so we say that the purusha is the cause for all of the sukha, dukkha, all of the affect, all of the judgment, all of what makes the experience alive. The experiences, though, that are being enjoyed by the purusha, all of the experiences that are being enjoyed by the purusha, by the atma, are only from the standpoint of the prakriti. So imagine like this. You say the purusha is the enjoyer of the prakriti, or of the gunas of the prakriti, the qualities of the prakriti. That means the enjoyer of whatever is taking place in the mind, whatever is being perceived through the sense organs, whatever type of emotions or vrittis are there, that is being enjoyed by the purusha. But that enjoyment requires the presence of the prakriti. If you imagine the prakriti not being there to be enjoyed, what is the purusha doing? What is the atman doing from its own standpoint? In other words, if you were to remove the prakriti sense organs, or the maya sense organs, because here prakriti and maya are synonyms, you remove the prakriti sense organs, you remove the prakriti thought modification, the prakriti emotion, you know, what is happening to the atma? In other words, nothing. But if nothing is happening to the atma, this is what I'm trying to make. When you remove the prakriti, which when it's there is known, what is happening to the atma when the prakriti is there? See, what I'm saying is that the enjoyment, when we say enjoyer, knower, hearer, seer, all of these things require consciousness, right? But does consciousness itself become a knower? Does consciousness become a knower? Or does consciousness lend itself to the mind, which allows the mind to be a knower? So in other words, if I hold the mind up being sattva, if I were to hold the mind up to consciousness, you know, or if that sattva mind were to enjoy consciousness, from the standpoint of the mind, which is sattva, there is the mind becomes known, right? The thought becomes known because it's enjoying consciousness. And so because the thought becomes known, we can say that the atma is a knower. But in reference to what? Only in reference to the known thought. And so if I get rid of the known thought, or if I'm looking at the atma at me from my own standpoint, I'm not doing anything. I'm not knowing anything. The sattva is enjoying the consciousness, allowing the vritti to be known, right? And because we say it is known because of the conscious being, and so the conscious being is then interpreted to be a knower. But actually, it is because of the conscious being that the vritti is known, or the vritti or the emotion is enjoyed, because without the conscious being, there would be nothing. There would be no enjoyment, no perception, no knower. But from the standpoint of the conscious being, consciousness itself, what is it doing to contribute to any type of activity like knowership or enjoyership? Because all it is simple consciousness. You see what I mean? So in this type of understanding, the satya mitya has to become really clear. So let me just talk around it a little bit more. There's some more things you need to I want you to be seeing about this. When we're talking about satya mitya, what we mean is that the prakriti has no separate existence at all apart from what is satyam. And what is satyam is changeless conscious being, is Brahman, is me, is the self. What that means is that the prakriti, this whole creation, or the body, mind, sense organs, are only the purusha. They are only atma. They have nothing of their own. They're only the self. They're only me. Because there's no separate existence. Like we talk very simply, the pot is only the clay. It has no other being, it has no other reality at all, it is only the clay. I say like this, this prakriti, with all of its complexity, with sattva, rajas, and tamas, what is responsible for all the karya karana, all cause and effect, and all the body, the mind, the sense organs, the projection of all duality, all of this is only me. It doesn't belong to anyone else, it doesn't exist in any other way, it is my manifestation. But being my manifestation, and at the same time having no being separate from me, right, then from its own standpoint, I become a knower. I become an enjoyer. I become a doer. I become a thinker. I become a seer. But in order for me to become a doer, a thinker, a seer, somebody who has sukha and dukkha, you know, somebody who's born in this yoni, in this womb, or in that womb, as we'll see in the next verse. All of this activity, all of these experiences require maya. They require the prakriti. Without the prakriti, there is no such experience. Think of it like this. If I have a dream, The entire dream, what is responsible for the entire manifestation, allows for very complex experiences. It allows for knower, the knower known, the doer, to be a doer, to be a knower, to be somebody who has, who is accruing dharma and adharma, the one who has punya papa, the one who transmigrates, takes birth after birth after birth, according to the punya and papa. The one who is themselves as a jiva subject to all cause and effect. So all of the experiences in the dream that are taking place, including the knowership, including the enjoyership, won't take place without the prakriti. When the prakriti, when the maya goes into unmanifest condition, none of those experiences are there at all. There is no knowing, knowership. There is no enjoyership. There is no kartritvam, doership. There is no accruing of punya and papa. There is no transmigration, you know. There is no moksha. There is no bondage, you know. None of these things have any existence whatsoever. But when all of those things are there, this knowership and the whole prakriti is manifest, and the jiva, upadhi, is manifest, then all of those things exist. The knowership, the seeing, the doing, all of these things exist, but only from the standpoint of the prakriti. But without consciousness, without conscious being, there would be no such thing. In other words, without conscious being, there could be no knowership. Without conscious being, there couldn't be a hearer, because there would be no consciousness that to allow hearing to take place. If it were taking place, nobody would know it. That's why I said the Bokchuktuan. Say, if that's why I use the example of, say, a camera. A camera is clicking away. Say it's a wind-up camera. It's one of those wind-up cameras. It's taking film. So it's doing, it's acting like a mind in a way. You could even put it on a swivel. You know, the camera is running. And so it's just surveying the, you know, everything that comes within its scope. But there's no knower. All of the activity of a knower is there without the knowership. For there to be knowership, there has to be consciousness. The problem is for jiva is that the conscious being that I am hasn't been at all in any way differentiated from the prakriti. This is prakriti. I give consciousness, the conscious being that I am, to this prakriti. The mind is prakriti. I give the conscious being that I am to the prakriti. As though give it. Because in one level, and just I can as equally say that all of this prakriti is conscious being. Just like pot is the clay. All of this is conscious being. But when I focus on conscious being per se, on me, myself, right, then there's no prakriti. And there's no knowership. There's known. Let me put it this way. The knowership, the enjoyership that the prakriti experiences from its own standpoint, upon analysis, resolves into just me, the known. And that's the reality. The whole creation, the whole prakriti, when it is up, it is known. When the prakriti goes into unmanifest condition, what is left is it is known without the prakriti. Right? Prakriti is manifest, it is known. Prakriti goes into unmanifest condition, nothing happens to the knownness, because the knownness is just a word for consciousness. So conscious being, the me, the purusha, becomes the knower, the enjoyer, when the prakriti is up. But when the prakriti is down in unmanifest condition, this idea of knower, known, enjoyer, enjoyed, this duality, resolves into the knownness of the subject and the knownness of the object. You say it again. For a jnani, one thing that has been recognized, when you recognize your being, the conscious being that you are, in the recognition of that being, you recognize the knownness, the conscious being that you are, as the very self of the subject. This body, mind, sense organs, you know, enjoys me, the conscious being. But the object also equally enjoys me, the conscious being. So I'm the conscious being of whatever I perceive, and I'm the conscious being of what is denoted as the perceiver. So the sattva, my mind, my sense organs, because they as though reflect consciousness, they're called the knower. The objects that I don't identify with are called the known. But when I do this viveka, the knownness, right, the very knownness that allows the mind to be known and the sense organs to be known, is the knownness, or the knownness, the me that enlivens the mind and the sense organs, is the same consciousness that enlivens all of the objects. So I look at all of you, and all of you are known. It means all of you exist in consciousness. But my sense organs and mind also exist in the same consciousness. And so what happens when I recognize that the consciousness that allows the mind to be a knower is the same consciousness that allows the objects of knowledge to be known? So the consciousness that allows me to be a knower allows the, let me put it this way, the conscious being, me, that allows the mind to be a knower is the same conscious being that allows the objects of the mind to be known. See what I mean? Like if you have a, that's why the dream analogy is so important. In the dream analogy, it's very easy to see that the conscious being that you are is the conscious being of the knower and the conscious being of the known. Right? There's only one conscious being there. But if I am the conscious being of both the knower and the known, from my own standpoint, I'm either the knower or the known. If I'm the conscious being of the knower and the known, then I'm not a knower or known. See what I mean? Another way of saying it, if I am the conscious being because of whom your mind is lit up, say this is a dream room, your mind is lit up and is known, your mind is lit up and is known, your mind is lit up and is known, all minds are lit up, all minds are known, because of me, then the knownness is me, but not the knowership, not the idea of knowership. I'm the consciousness which lights up all minds, but all minds are performing their function and all sense organs are performing their function, right? But all minds and sense organs are of the same mitya, maya material as the rest of the dream. It's just some are sattva and they reflect consciousness and others are not sattva and they don't reflect consciousness. But I'm the same stable self because of which all things are known. To really, let me just circle this a little bit more, to really understand this experientially, one has to recognize that you're actually not having an experience of knowership. The experience you're having in reference to the world is knownness. All the way through, you say, I am a knower in reference to the object known. Like because of my eyes, I'm a knower of the painting. Because of my ears, I'm a hearer of the sound. But you're just making this up, in a way. Because actually, all of your experiences are known all the way to the self. It's like the painting is known, you know, the intervening space is known, my sense organs are known, you know, because of which the painting is seen, my eyes themselves are known, so this is all known. The mind, which is hooked up to the mind, to the eyes, that is also known. The vritti is known, and conscious being is known. So where in this experience is there really a knower? In terms of the experience, you can attribute knowership. You can attribute the reason that something is known. Like the reason that painting is known is because of my eyes. That's the reason it is known. There's no experience of a knower. The reason it is known is because of my eyes. And the reason my eyes are allowing this to be known is because my mind is backing the eyes. But the thought, you don't experience the thought as a knower. You experience the thought as known. And then when we look at conscious being itself, just as me, there is nobody knowing me. I am known. So it's very impossible, actually, to find in this world of experience, in this duality, any experience of knowing. That's only language. The experience really is of knownness. Every experience that you have on every level is known. Now, what I'm saying here is that the knownness is satyam. The knownness is Brahman. That's the reality. And so in this room, for instance, the whole room is known. The whole room is Brahman. There is no experience that you can have on any level that is not known. Knownness is consciousness. Knownness, consciousness is a completed state. Knownness is not an action. Right? There's no action there. There's no doership there. There's no seeing there. It's already complete. It's all finished. It is known. And so this is knownness is Brahman. That's the truth of everything. That's the Satyam. And all of this duality is superimposed on it. And because the duality, the Prakriti, has made of these three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, the sattva aspect, as though reflects knownness, the tamas aspect doesn't reflect knownness at all. Like the chair, from its own standpoint, is not reflecting knownness from its own standpoint, but this mind is reflecting knownness from its standpoint. And so if you think of the dream creation, the whole dream creation enjoys knownness, which is awareness. But the objects, the sattva, rajas, and tamas within the dream creation are creating a different reality there. There's all kinds of movement, motion, there's birth and death. There's the predominance of sattva going through the whole creation, which gives it that ishwaratvam, the sense of the whole thing being an infinite mind from the standpoint of that's the pervasive sattva. The sattva that is encased by tamas, this body, mind, and the sense organs and the mind that are encased by the tamas, by the body, enjoy sattva, enjoy, reflect consciousness, but they are limited by the tamas of the physical body. And so it becomes limited. Whereas the sattva that pervades the whole creation, the whole dream creation, allows for omniscience, the experience of omniscience. There is no one that is omniscient. Brahman is omniscient. Okay, Brahman is omniscient from the standpoint of the Maya Upadhi. There's no one in the Maya Upadhi who is an omniscient knower. The infinite creation, with the sattva going through it, the whole creation is known because of the sattva. Right? And all of it has for its being only one Brahman. And so that Brahman itself, from its own standpoint, is known. So the whole Maya Upadhi is known, not because... not just from the standpoint of the Prakriti, it is known because the Prakriti is Brahman. The Prakriti itself is Brahman, but Brahman is free of the Prakriti. Conscious being doesn't do anything to become this creation, and yet the creation has no being apart from Brahman. That's what we mean by the whole Satya Mitya. The Satya Mitya is, you know, the Prakriti is Brahman, but Brahman is free of the Prakriti. Brahman itself doesn't go through it. It's called Vivarta Upadana Karanam. The Brahman doesn't go through anything at all to become, any change at all to become this creation. It's because the Maya itself, it is nothing but Brahman, in the sense that Maya has no being at all apart from Brahman to be a separate entity. So because if you understand that, it means, and you understand Brahman as Vivarta Upadana Karanam, it means that material cause that doesn't go through any change at all, to become the effect, this material cause, when it manifests as this creation itself not going through any change at all, then, from the standpoint of the Maya Upadhi, Brahman sees, Brahman hears, Brahman talks, you know, Brahman is subject to punya and papa, the whole creation, all of this whole dance that is going on is nothing but Brahman, you know? So from the standpoint of the Maya, Brahman is seeing, Brahman is hearing. So you have to talk like this, which the Upanishads and the Gita does. Brahman, Brahman, seeing doesn't see. Hearing doesn't hear. Enjoying doesn't enjoy. Talking doesn't talk. Walking doesn't walk. Because there's nobody else here but Brahman. And yet, it requires that Maya Upadhi for all of this duality to be taking place. And this duality, this mitya, has no independent being apart from Brahman. So now, what we're doing in these verses, in the next one, is we have to until you have knowledge, the Prakriti and the Purusha, the Maya and Brahman, are only one thing. There is only Maya. We don't call it Maya. We call it this creation, of which I am a part. That's what is here. This creation is what exists. I know this creation. I'm the knower of this creation through my sense organs and my mind. I am a conscious being walking around in this inner creation. The whole creation exists. Everything exists. And the body and the mind and the sense organs exist. But only human beings are enjoying consciousness. And they enjoy consciousness because they have a mind and sense organs. That's what we know. There's no Brahman and Maya. There's no Purusha and Prakriti. This is all the teaching that has to unravel all of these things until you can see that, wait a minute, in our experience, you know, there's just so many different prakriyas. But one is that in our experience, we give existence to this creation. You never have an experience that is away from existence, and so therefore in your mind, everything exists. Right? Because any experience that you have exists. So, of course, everything exists. So existence is given to the creation. But we don't realize that, well, wait a minute. Everything exists, and also everything is known. That's true. But if we just stop for a minute, everything exists, actually, everything exists when it's there. The only thing that really exists is existence itself. Everything else is coming into existence and out of existence. Coming into being and out of being. The common denominator is changeless being. That never changes. All change, all experience comes into and out of being. Being is the common denominator. It never modifies in any way. Everything is just simply all change, all experiences coming into being and going out of being. Being doesn't come into being and going out of being. Being is the constant. That's what we mean. Being is the vivarta upadana karanam. Being is what is actually here, never going through any modification at all. And that being, we say that being, that sat, is chit. It's not just being. It's not inert being. It's being which is chit, which is consciousness itself. Why? Because actually, every experience comes into being and goes out of being, but every experience, we'll just take for now from the standpoint of the jiva, everything that comes into being and goes out of being is actually coming into consciousness and going out of consciousness. If you look at just your individual experience, and then we can go into the Mandukya, but just in your individual experience, everything is coming into knownness, into consciousness. Every experience you have, you can say everything comes into and out of being. Well, how about it? You say yes. Everything comes into and out of being. Everything comes into and out of knownness. Just take your own experience. Knownness and being both are non-objectifiable and inseparable. You don't have being on one side and knownness on the other. That's why we say the sat, existence itself, is self-evident consciousness. The nature of existence in terms of our experience that we can relate to in terms of the prakriti is existence, being, is knownness. And knownness is being. And so if you look at your experience just in this room, everything is and everything is known. You experience in any vritti in your mind. The vrittis are coming and going, of course, but whatever is there is and it is known. And it's really not is and is known. It just is known. It is self-evident. Is known includes is and known. It is known. And the is known is invariable. It's invariable. You can never, it's one thing you can never get away from. The self-evident is knownness. Now that self-evident that is knownness, anything, including deep sleep or where the mind is in unmanifest condition, whatever condition, whatever state is there, enjoys this is knownness. If the mind is in unmanifest condition, there's just is knownness without any commentary on the part of the mind. There's no commentary at all. The mind isn't even functioning. But when the mind wakes up, right, when the mind wakes up, then whatever the vritti is in the deep sleep state, that is also a vritti because the mind goes into its causal condition, deep sleep, and wakes up again. So when the mind wakes up, it says, oh, if it's in a stocking and sophisticated language, well, you know, when I go into deep sleep, my mind goes into causal condition. So at that time, there is really nothing known, but when I wake up, I can tell you all about that experience. Because now, I, the mind, am awake and I can talk. But when I'm in causal condition, when I go into deep sleep, then I'm simply not functioning, and so the is-knownness is what it's, which itself, the me and myself, is not a knower. I am is-known. I, the Atma, am is-known. I'm not knowing anything. I'm is-known. So now the deep sleep state, it is known, but I'm not, nobody's talking about it. Right? Because it's in causal condition. When the mind wakes up, it says, well, in the deep sleep, there's no knowledge, and you're describing it from memory. Right? What's important about understanding this is that the Atma, the self, its nature is known. Not knowing, not a knower. To give this attribute of knowership, we have to have sense organs or a mind. That's where we use the language knower. We use the language. We don't have that experience. We use the language. We don't have the experience because the experience is known. If your mind is awake and up, whatever vritti is there, that vritti is known. Whatever perception is there through the eyes, that perception is known. Whatever imagination is there, the imagination is known. You cannot find a knower. You can attribute knowership to the instruments that are causing something to be known. But the actual experience is one that is known. And that is knownness is the Atma. Without the Atma, without Brahman, right, this enjoyership, consciousness on the part of the Prakriti wouldn't exist. The is-knownness that allows the Prakriti to be, or the Maya to be, a sentient being. So you have to be able to separate the Satyam from the Mithya to be free. To be free. I mean, it's only the Mithya, it's only the Maya where the bondage exists in the first place. But for you, the Maya Upadhi, to be free, you have to recognize what's the Maya Upadhi and who am I? I am free. I'm never not free. Nothing ever touches me, in fact. I can never be bound. I've never been bound and never will be bound. It's not a possibility. Yeah. But I have to be able to recognize that amidst all of this, which is nothing but bound. There is no freedom from bondage in the creation. Because bondage means that which is subject to continual birth and death, continual change. There's nothing to hang on to. You know, for any type of lasting security, there's no security, there's only momentary ananda. It's a very distressing condition. The only thing that allows you to be free from distress is the illusion that you can all put some things together and actually make it work. If I do this and this and I act like this and do this and do this, then I'll reach this utopian fullness.
A completed state.
A completed state. But it's not possible to reach a completed state within Maya. The only way to reach the completed state is to recognize that you are that completed state. And the other very amazing thing is that in this Maya, in the Prakriti, with the body, the mind, and sense organs, and all that's going on, you do continually have experiences of myself as a complete being. It's just momentary. It just means that the prakriti, your mind settles down for a moment. It just settles down for a moment and you're fine. Just for a moment, you're fine. You are always fine. But the mind needs to settle for it to feel fine. The mind's fineness, being fine, is only attributable to its condition. And the mind is always changing, and so the sense organs are always changing. And the mind you don't have a lot of control over, so you can be happy that you're fine for the moment. And that can change at any time. Unconscious, you know, forces can change it. Bad situations in the creation can change it. Reactions can change it. And so the illusion of fineness, of being fine, is it's so ephemeral. It's coming and going and coming and going based upon mental states. Your sense of being fine is based upon a mental state. For the jnani, the sense of being fine is not based upon a mental state. It has nothing to do, really, honestly. This is moksha. Your fineness has nothing to do with the mental state. It has to do with the removing of the ajnanam that has caused the superimposition where your being is superimposed on your body and your mind and sense organs and on the world. When you are, because of knowledge, yourself is free, not that it was ever bound at any time, but from the standpoint of the mind, which had suffered this ajnanam and the superimposition, your being was very intimately tied to mental states. And the mental states were tied to the body and to your experiences. But actually your being, the knownness, the sat-chit, which is ananda, which is whole and complete, is ever changelessly present. It has nothing to do with the mental state. From itself, it's not going through mental states. You are always the same. Whatever the mental state is, you are always the same. And so if the ahankara, you know, is, because of the removal of ajnanam, is released from this body, mind, sense organs, then the aham, this word, aham, me, lands upon the Atma, me, who is here. I'm the one who's really the truth of this whole thing. And for me, I'm not a mental state. Yeah. And so I'm the constant, and the constant is whole and complete. And so whatever the mental state is, I, the whole and complete one, am present to that mental state. From the standpoint of the mental state, I'm the knower of the mental state, like a mental institution. Knower the mental institution. But from me, you know, I am not that mental state. That's not my self-experience. That really is the freedom. The secondary gain of moksha is that when the mind recognizes that I am whole, that myself is whole, and I am the one the mind has always been seeking, then the problems of samsara become mitya. They're no longer real. And as I mature, this emotional lag time of the mind continuing because of its, you know, beginningless lifetimes of trauma, continues going, running around in the world trying to create a situation where I can relax and be happy. That all drops off. It drops off and it drops off and it drops off, because why should I run around trying, you know, to eat the graham crackers, so to speak, when I'm right here? It's like, that's why in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, this, no one goes out to the middle of the river to get water from the well. You know, when they dig wells in the middle of the river, and then in the summer when the river, when it's hot and the river dries, they go out to the middle of the river, which is now dry riverbank, and get their water. But what about in the rainy season, when the river is flowing? They would never consider you know, trying to go into the middle to find the well to get the water. And so when the wholeness and ananda, when the mind has recognizes I am that, there's no distance between the mind and that wholeness. What does it care? Why do I have to have this be a particular way? If by some habitual thinking my mind wants it to be this particular way, initially you can go through some moments of getting upset because you're not getting your way. And then later on, you'll say it doesn't make any difference and you let it go. And then later on, you don't even think like that. It's just maturing into your experience, because the ananda you seek is the self that you are. And that's never away from you. That is moksha. This idea of mental states is samsara. If you think that, you know, it's like if you think that you need a particular type of mental state to be free once you have knowledge, then you don't have knowledge. It's not knowledge. And this thing is actually the trap. This is the trap. I need to have this series of mental states or these type of mental states so that I can be free. Mental states are not free. Mental states are mental states. That's the mind continually changing. Your knowledge will settle down your mind, because what's causing a lot of the tumultuousness in the mind is the ajnanam that makes my mind think it needs this, this, and this in order to be happy. That's the ajnanam. What about when that ajnanam is no longer there? What about when the mind realizes that its shanti, I mean the wholeness that it seeks, is the self that I am? That creates a different kind of mind. You know, that's why we use the 10th man story. There's a big difference between the mental states of the 10th man who thinks the boy is drowned in the river and the 10th man who realizes there never was a drowning and I'm the 10th man. The mental state is very different. Right? But the freedom is really in the recognition. What causes the change in the mental state is the recognition of the 10th man. So in my recognition that I am Brahman, that my being is the wholeness that I seek, that recognition has the secondary gain of settling down the mind, which had been banging its head on the wall, trying to solve this problem of becoming a whole and complete and worthwhile, respectable, you know, being adored by others. Satchit Ananda. May I exist, may I be very intelligent, and may I be loved by all beings. Ananda is the loved, completed state. Chit is the knowledge, the knownness that the whole creation enjoys. So it's like saying, may I exist, don't let me die.
What?
May I exist, don't let me die. I'll die tomorrow, not today. Let me be. Why do I have that? Because that's the truth of who I am. There's never a change in being. I am timeless. So your mind says, let me be. Let me exist. Let me be. Then you realize, I do exist. And I am free from time. There is no loss for me in terms of being. My being is changeless. The being that I am now is the being that I was a billion years ago and will be a billion years from now. I'm free from time. I'm the very basis of time. I am the very sat that my mind is seeking, my mind is protecting. I am the chit. I am the numbness. I go on collecting knowledge, collecting knowledge, collecting knowledge, so that I can somehow gain this knowledge so that everything is known by me. But actually, I'm the very knownness that all known things enjoy. I am the completed state, really, of what I seek in terms of knowledge. I'm the chit. And let me become whole. Let me become complete. Let me become full. You know? Let me be loved. That is me, that is the Ananda. I am the Satchit Ananda, and until I know that, I'm seeking Satchit Ananda. I'm seeking myself, running around seeking myself in the world, because I don't know who I am. When I know who I am the Sat of this whole creation. I'm the being the whole creation enjoys. I'm the Chit, the knownness that the whole creation enjoys. I'm the Ananda, the wholeness that the whole creation enjoys, in fact. The Ananda, to recognize that you are the Ananda, the wholeness that I actually seek, is a major recognition. It's maybe the hardest. Partially the reason for that is the way we define the word Ananda, bliss. We're looking for different blissful shanti experiences, mental states. I have preferable mental states. But the trick is to, like for instance when we did the relaxation meditation, the trick is to notice who you are and then ask why is they call this Ananda? You're just sitting there silently as you're being, you've relaxed everything, so nothing's really bothering you. Then you say, why am I Ananda? Why am I Ananda? You just seriously ask. Is there anything more dear to me than the simple presence of me? Is there anything that means more? Is there anything I would rather get rid of that and have something else? And once you sit with that, you realize that it kind of can realize kind of like a little flash that I am the Ananda. This is what they mean by Ananda. It goes like that. Oh, this is what they mean by Ananda. This is why they use the word Ananda. And when you realize that, what they mean, that Ananda, which is me, is never not here. Never. There's no dukkha-vritti. There's no sukha-vritti. There's no experience which covers that in any way. And that's a major important awakening, so whatever magical word you want to use. It's not magical at all. It's actually very simple. But still we have to see it. And then that Satchit-Ananda, that is the Purusha, that is the Atma, that is Brahman, that is me. And because of me, because of my nature, this whole world gets to be known, gets to be enjoyed. All of these words come into existence because of conscious being. And you have to remember, it's not that there's conscious being me and Prakriti over here. There's no Prakriti that has any being apart from conscious being. But the Prakriti, so the knower, but the knowership and enjoyership and all of that require the Prakriti to be there so that there can be something which is known and something that is enjoyed. Again, interesting. Take enjoyed as a completed state. This, like known, is a completed state. All of our emotional experiences are completed states. They are what they are. You know, they're not active in the sense of knowing, know or known. They're experienced for what they are. But the what allows them to be experienced is consciousness. Without consciousness, they're inert. Okay.
Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
So, when you're seeking love or wanting to be wanted or feeling more together than feeling wanting to feel more together,
mm-hmm.
that's all in
Maya.
That's all in my, but it's all searching for the self because that's the nature of what my being is like.
You can say it like that. In fact, one thing I was trying to get to a little bit of this meditation, and if you followed it, it's something good to actually practice. Say when you have that feeling of, you know, wanting to be wanted or wanting to be loved or insecure, whatever the painful feeling is.
Yeah.
One thing to do is just deeply relax and don't push that feeling away. Just let your body totally relax, like with the meditation we did. Let your mind totally relax and then welcome that feeling in. And just continue in the presence of that feeling. You just welcome it in and you continue to relax and relax and relax. Without pushing it away, without reacting to it, just allow it to be there. Relax and relax and relax. And what happens is, whatever it is about that feeling starts to dissipate, and really what is left is your own swarupa, your own nature. You know? And in fact, the more you relax, the less... it's like this, like you could have the same image or the same feeling, but as you relax, the scary affect or hurtful affect of the image goes away. And so in doing that, you're breaking conditionings that are brought about by a relationship to a certain person or to a certain event that has happened. So it's triggering images.
Like this urge of, maybe you can work on this urge of wanting to be more together or... more there.
Mm-hmm. And so what if you just welcomed in that feeling, that emotion, that, oh, I want to be more together.
So more there.
And more there, okay.
Yeah.
You want to be more together and more there. And so you let that emotion just be. You let it be. Don't push it away. It's kind of like Rumi. You know, Rumi always says, you know, just to welcome everybody into your home. All of the scary ones, let them all just come in. You let it be there, and you don't push it away at all. You just relax and just accept it. And just relax. Let it relax, and you relax. And you let that feeling, as you welcome it in, you let that feeling relax. And what happens is because what had caused the pain is the mental tension that thought caused. It's not really even the thought or the image. It's that the image creates stress and tension.
Yeah.
And so as you relax, there's this image can still be there, or this thought can still be there, but there's no problem with it. Why? Because you've relaxed. What had caused the problem is the tension in the mind. That's what causes the dukkha. Say, you let that whole scary thing be there, except you're accepting it and you're relaxing. So whatever the thought is, whatever the feeling is, whatever, say if there's, in your life, if there's someone who has hurt you very badly, for instance, parent or a past relationship, or whatever it could be. And so if you even think about them, it can make you very angry.
Yeah.
Or you can have whatever emotions that are packed onto that particular person. So what if you... I'll just practice. It's a practice. It's a sadhana. As you relax, first you relax your body and you relax your mind. So you're already relaxed. Then you welcome in that image and see what happens. Can you let that, can you welcome that image in, not pushing it away, and just allowing yourself to relax in the presence of the image? One thing to remember is this. It is only an image. All of these introjects that we take in, mm-hmm. they're really only mental images. It's not somebody out here.
Mm-hmm.
But these mental images trigger, you know, intense reactions. So what if you deeply relax and then welcome them in, and if you just sit there with them, and then you also allow them to relax, you relax, you allow them to relax, the pain that the image causes doesn't cause that pain anymore. So you're actually deconditioning yourself. Hi, Tibby. Come on. What's the matter?
Oh, Tibbeth.
What's the matter? What time is it? No, we get more time, Tibby.
Needy little girl. Yeah. See that she's like, oh, it's...
Maybe she caught something.
She might have.
But you know, those images, then the key is just to relax, because the images seem so real, you know.
That's why I'm asking you to try that, to experiment with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And see.
Because the images feel like they need doctoring and repair, and you know, somebody.
Yeah, but they may need doctoring and repair. But this is a wonderful exercise to try. The first thing you have to do when you're doing an exercise like this is to let your body and mind already deeply relax. You don't want your mind to be tense and all of this, and then you bring a tense image into a tense mind. You know? So you want to welcome those kind of images into a mind that is already relaxed, with an attitude that you are able to welcome that in and just let it be there without any pushing of nothing. There's no pushing away. Allow it to be there, allow it to relax. If it's hard for the big things, try it with smaller things. But it actually, if you can do that, it has long-lasting effects. Because you're actually breaking a, what do you call it? You're like a groove.
Neurological.
Yeah. And then when you've released those, say we're doing a meditation like that, then you just sit with yourself just to kind of appreciate the very nature of your being itself, just of who you are. You know, when you're not tense, just the beauty of your, just that very simple presence. Start to, it's the third, when you're relaxed like that, then you can say questions like, what do they mean by Ananda in terms of me? It's the me that is here right now. How is that Ananda? How is that the beloved? So you can recognize kind of the, what they mean by that. It's a beautiful recognition.
Is that trick of relaxing with these images, is that, I'm not used to that very much. Is it a hard one to engage with?
Mm-mm.
Just
if it's too hard, don't do such a hard one. Don't bring in a monster. Bring in a little irritant. Relax the irritant. If there's so much like dvesha, you know, toward the image that there's no one that can remain relaxed to receive that, you know, then do those relaxations and bring in a lesser one so that you can experience. You're experiencing the mityatva, really, you know, of the illusory nature.
And the hold that it has.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, once you break those things, you know, it's hard to, you can really break them in a way that's, I would say, can be permanent. Those images and past experiences trigger reactions in your mind. And you don't even notice it because it all happens so fast.
Yeah. Yeah, before you know it, you're on your way.
You're on your way. But that's what, you know, meditation is so beautiful, really, because it slows everything down. So if you want to work on something, you know, You can invite problematic types of thoughts, or problematic people, or problematic emotions that kind of continually come up and take over. You can work with just sitting with those and relaxing till they lose their hold. They lose that their hold on you.
Rather than trying to solve them.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's...
Yeah, some things actually don't need to be solved at all. They just need to not cause you trouble. In fact, some of these past things, you know, past hurts, and they're taking up... Well, I forget who the guy is, Lukoff or something. They're taking up too much real estate in your mind. Taking way too much real estate. You know, they're continually coming back and bothering you and hurting you and all this. Making a mess, making a misery.
Like perpetual, you know.
So this particular exercise, it's very good for Satya Nitya because it allows you just to relax and just be with yourself. It's like the pot deciding to relax into the clay. You're just relaxing and relaxing to the degree that the mithya, the nama-rupa, the names and forms and whatever, is just so relaxed that they're not creating any type of competition in terms of affect with just your simple being.
And this relaxing, it's different than turning away from...
It has nothing to do with turning away. Because actually we can use these turning aways, and we do, you know, in meditative techniques, but on another level, there is nothing to turn away from. There is nowhere to turn, because you are the sat, kind of the is-knownness of all experience. You're the truth of all experience. So there's nowhere to turn, because there's nowhere that is not you. You know, that's why what were we doing? Was that in the Mandukya? It was in Driktrisha Viveka, I think. That yatra yatra mano yati, wherever the mind goes, tetra tetra samadhi yaha, there's the samadhi. Wherever the mind goes, is there that is samadhi. But because there's no place that the self is not. It's the being, it's the very being of every experience. So whatever your mind's doing, wherever it's going, there I am. And so if you take any given moment and you just let the mind relax so that you can recognize the me that is there in my own, from my own standpoint, instead of always from the standpoint of the thought or the emotion.
I think there's a couple of requirements, and I'm so immature and resistant to dealing with some of these things. And one of the requirements, I think, is that you have to know before, you have to come to terms beforehand of knowing, having a clue about those things that set you off. You know, you have to understand what those things are.
Yeah.
That's number one, so you have to deal with that. And then number two is, not, you know, when you're finally relaxed in meditation, oh, I'm not anxious and upset. I certainly don't want to screw around with that. Thing that is going to... You know,
yeah, I've got rid of the monster, just leave it out there. But you know what? The thing is that if you do get into that very beautiful, relaxed space, often there is enough relaxation to be able to withstand bringing another type of thought in. When you prime yourself that not to push it away, not to do anything, not to think about it, just to allow it to be there. Without doing anything, just being. And then you can even continue to relax more in the presence of that.
Mm.
And then you can allow that thought to relax, as to allow the image to relax. So the reason that it's good, I mean, there's many, many reasons to try something like this, but one is what we were just saying, you don't want to bring in a negative to screw up your peaceful moment of peace. But bringing in this negative into a relaxed state and being able to sit with it actually gives the mind a much more depth of relaxation, because this is one negative that is no longer causing fear. It's no longer, in this moment, doesn't have the power to do that, to upset the apple cart, so to speak. That's a huge thing. And actually, for each one of the things that you do that with, the mind has now a different relationship with that. So in a way, there's something semi-permanent to these practices. It's not that they come back, differently. And a lot of these things, with these type of thoughts, you haven't done anything like that. You haven't taken like the particular issue and allowed that issue to relax. All the mind knows is that that issue brings reaction. That's what it knows. So whenever that person or situation comes into your mind, or whatever the riff is, that's how it's trained.
Well, this relaxing, it seems like it would change how the brain electrical system works a little bit. I mean,
I think it does, but I don't know all the mechanics, the electronics of the thing. The brain's electronics.
It gets a lot like the communicating with the little ones and comforting them, except that it's talking with feelings rather than words. Giving a sense of relaxation and comfort to the mind, no matter what is going on.
Yeah, and especially in this particular exercise, you're actually dealing with realities that are adult realities. You can do the same. When you go into the little ones inside, often there's more of that presence, but also some dialogue. You know, you can do that the same way, but especially with ways that your mind is triggered now in the present, even if there are little children inside that are really causing that. But to break some of these reactions that we have in the present based upon difficult relationships, difficult people, ways that we've been hurt. I mean, I don't know anybody who hasn't been hurt in one way or another, and we're carrying hurts or angers or ways we've been betrayed. There's certain situations that happen in life that scar you, and it creates rifts. Repeating thought processes.
So this feeling that it's not only me, then you can give up on. Sometimes you think it's only me having this. Everybody else is.
No, everybody has their things. Otherwise, like Swamiji, we have this Uttama Adhikari, the Madhyama and Mandana. The Uttama Adhikari means the most qualified student. It's like Shweta Ketu in the Chandogya Upanishad. His father was teaching him, and he had to teach him this Tattvamasi 9 times. Even he had to be taught 9 times, but that's all he needed. Took maybe an hour. He was finished.
Well, I've heard it 900 times, I think.
But Swamiji said,
I'll be more than that for some years. I'm sure you've heard more than 900.
There's no Uttama Adhikari. There's not an Uttama Adhikari. We're Madhyama Mandana Adhikaris. It means the mind has. It's not an insult. All it's saying that in this Kali Yuga, in our situation with all of the things that human beings are going through, the mind has stuff that it has to work through. And we're living in a world of we're underwater in a dharma. We're underwater in so many ways.
No kidding.
But there's work to be done. But it certainly doesn't mean that you can't gain knowledge. We gain self-knowledge, and we learn how to work with the mind to bring it out of its hurts, bring it out of its misery in ways that are effective. And we can not bother also, but there are ways, there's things that we can do that really help. So why not do those things? They really help the mind.
So it seems like this relaxing is not just, it's not in the seat of contemplation. It sounds like it's a...
You do it in the seat of contemplation first, and then it becomes natural. Like say you have one of these repeating hurts in the mind, and you know how to relax. When it comes, because when it comes you can just be there with it and just relax instead of going in that other route. But the reason even you can do all of that is really because of knowledge. It's because of vairagya. Knowledge and vairagya are, in a sense, one and the same. Knowledge brings about vairagya. And what vairagya means is that I don't have the idea that this object or this situation is going to make me happy. I no longer want to use, or I don't use situations for that. Like you have to be in this way so that I can be whole and complete.
Mm-hmm.
Now that type of vairagya and that knowledge, that maturity, that takes time. You don't just listen once and all of a sudden I don't need the world in any way to be whole and complete. You grow into that with your understanding. And you come to this knowledge with more or less of that vairagya, that viveka vairagya, more or less of that assimilation. You know? And it's just, I have to be careful too when we talk about vairagya, because sometimes it's been taught in a way kind of like sour grapes. In fact, sour grapes vairagya, there's a name for it. It's called jihasa vairagya, as opposed to jignasa vairagya, vairagya born of knowledge versus vairagya born of disappointment. That's jihasa. Jihasa would be like, you really, really wanted something, really wanted it. Somebody else gets it, like somebody else got this job that you wanted so badly. Somebody else gets it. And he's like, I didn't want that anyway. Who cares? I don't want it anyway.
What is there?
What is there? Nothing. I don't want to do that. I don't care. That's jihasa. But then, it was Swamiji tells the story, of course, he makes everything into a beautiful story. But then when the person who was going to get to the job doesn't get the job, and it's after, and it's offered to you after all, you know, then you're so excited that now you have the job, everything's fine. You know? Now we can get on with everything we were going to do. I was going to take sannyasa. No, I don't want to take sannyasa. Who needs it? I have no interest in sannyasa. Why did I want to take sannyasa? That's jihasa. So Swamiji calls it sour grapes. It disappears quickly. But jignasa means that desire for knowledge. That vairagya is born from the assimilation of your experience, you know. And with knowledge, that jihasa vairagya, jignasa vairagya is something that continues to grow, because you're so much more free, your mind is so much more free, it has so much more shanti when it's not running around trying to make the world be in a particular way, but it's just being with the world as it is and contributing and all of that. You can contribute, try to make things better, try to help the situation, all of these type of things. But you need not have this angst in terms of your own well-being that if this isn't straightened out and this isn't made like this, my life is over.
Ruined.
My life is ruined. Yeah. I have no chance for happiness. Mm-hmm. This person has ruined my life. I didn't get this, didn't happen for me, and so now I'm finished. It's all terrible, you know? And it's not worth it, because it's not true. If it was true, maybe we could...
So that image comes up, and then we do this relax.
If that type of image comes up and you can't blow it away, you know, like these three levels that they talk about.
Yeah.
You can't just, let's not go there. If you can't do that, then you can sit and just, depending on what type of, I mean, there's so many things you can do. This is only one of them.
Okay.
One of them is to just, you know, stop, recognize the feeling, and then just don't push it away. See if you can just relax. Or else, when you're meditating, bring that back and see if you can just allow it in without, allow it into a relaxed state. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like one thing. There's so many different things we learn how to do in terms of working with our mind and our emotions and the things that it, there's so many, we have so many different things that we can do to help it. It's not always just, it's not just one thing. This particular thing that we did tonight, that's worthy of practice so that you have, you know what it is and you have that skill. Inner child work is worthy of practice so that you know what it is, so that you have these skills, and when the need for it comes up, then you use that, you know?
But right, in all of what you teach, it always comes down to one thing, relax. The embracing is relaxing.
Mm-hmm. The reason for that is because you are fine. Mm. You know, the mind is tense because of some maya. You know, some projection, the mind is creating pain. You know, and so the tension is what's causing so much dukkha. And so to the degree that you can relax and hold it to that degree, ananda, the, you know, the mind is enjoying more and more shanti, and your nature itself is ananda. And so in reality there is no problem. In reality there's no problem. The problem is maya. See, even for us, for our childhood traumas and all of these things, it's not that they are not there, but they're, the mind is very pliable, unlike a table, you know? And so the nightmares of the mind can dissipate by relaxation. Say the mind is in just a horrible, painful state. If you know how to be with it, to not push it away, to not reject it, you know, that causes a lot more tension, not to just allow it to be and to relax, it goes away.
It's yeah, like it seems like if you mess with the mind, it gets worse, you know?
If you're disrespectful or rude or isolating, the worst thing, nobody wants to be isolated or shunned or shamed. These are states of being that are intolerable. The worst they say, Swamiji was talking about this actually, is to be shunned.
Yeah.
Shunned is another type of isolation, you know. And so what if you're not isolating these emotional states, you're not shunning them, you know, you're just being there, totally relaxed, you know, not pushing away, you know, then that allows those pains to dissipate. And as they dissipate, they go away. It's not like physical reality. The relaxation, and the relaxation, the pain that's being held there goes away.
And eventually you can do it without even sitting.
Just naturally.
Yeah. Because you know what it feels like.
Yeah. Yeah, you know how to do it.
Well, it's good to know that shred dog can come in real handy here.
That what?
Shred dog can come in real handy. Because it's either going to be this way or it's not. So it's kind of put your money where your mouth is, you know?
That's right. That's true. With something like this, there's no harm in trying it. If you're dealing with something too big, just say, too big. Let's try another one. Bring in another thought that's not so overwhelming. But relaxation does wonders. I mean, it's really causing the pain, not the image. The image is not causing the pain. The tension is causing the pain. And what you're bringing up are images. They're not physical realities.
Because and they can tie you up in knots. I mean, you can
totally. Be horrible. I'm talking from experience. I haven't done all these things for nothing. Yeah. We pass on what works. Okay, should we stop?
Yeah, those are wonderful. I don't know why the classes always get better.